Monday, April 28th, this is the House Committee on Audit and Human Services Budget Reform. We'll be starting as a subcommittee. Before we do that, you had a couple items, Mr. Bacobian?
Yes, thank you, Chair, Vice Chair. At your desk, this is just an FYI only. There's an article from the New York Times that was just on the cutbacks in Medicaid that a number of states are implementing or considering implementing. Oregon is not mentioned there, but a number of states are, and that was just, again, just an FYI. And then for those of you who did not get a chance to see the Salem paper Sunday and then today and tomorrow, there's a series on health care in the prison system versus what's occurring in Oregon. Generally, I have some copies of that if you'd like one. So, and with that, we just have a piece of written testimony if you want to kind of summarize that, I guess.
Yes, for the record, we received written testimony from Dolores Hubert, the chair of the Health and Long-Term Care Committee of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, dated April 28th. Just briefly, concerns that maybe House Bill 3624 is moving too fast, but obviously not. We're having a public hearing today, and not a work session. But concerned that we're proposing massive changes, and they, folks need a chance to digest those. Concerns about the lack of exception for mandatory from mandatory enrollment, plus exceptions for continuity of care and flexibility, but the complete copy is here for members and the public if they so desire a copy. With that, we'll start the public testimony, and Gene Lewis, you're up first. Okay, and for the record, introduce yourself and talk right into those microphones. They don't pick up real well.
Okay, I'm Jean Lewis, and I am from St. Helens, Oregon, and the reason I am here is on the medical issues, not that you haven't already been bombarded with that, but I support you because I do know how hard you are working, and because I have been in accounting, I understand the dollars. It's not your fault, and you're trying to do an awful lot with very little funds. And how I ever got started on this is, number one, is my medications, like I say, were $4,000 a month. And I was given a death sentence when I received that letter because one of my shots, which is $50 a day, as soon as it was to run out, I would have died within 1 to 3 days. Thank goodness my caregivers took the effort to try to help me. And I was able to do the phoning. They got me in contact with the pharmaceuticals. And at the very deadline, I was able to get resolution. And part of the reason I've been speaking to the different senators, I've even been to Washington, D.C. I have met with Hillary Clinton's office, Gordon Smith's office, Henry Waxman of California. And he has asked me to even keep him in the loop of anything that I can accomplish. And the one thing I learned out there was that Oregon, well, I've always known Oregon has always been a leader in our country. For all different things, we've always been a leader, and I'm very proud of that. And I found out from the people I met with in Washington, D.C., they are watching very closely. They said that the medical program that had been put in place for Oregon was such an awesome project, and they were watching because they felt it was a good program. The shortfalls, they're asking for, you know, if we get it fixed. They want to know because Henry Waxman wants to follow Oregon's lead in California and the national. And just so that you know that you are, you know, we are a special state. And but some of the things that I was looking at your bill here, and I see some of the things that you are putting in place are some of the same things that I have thought of and trying to suggest. One of the things is right after I received that letter and became a little hysterical on my own because of knowing that I was going to die at that point. And I lost control in my car one day, and I screamed out, yelling, why am I still alive, and God, what am I supposed to do? When I finally got composure and got home, there was a message on my answering machine. Channel 6 News had asked for me to be on their news program to represent the health problem. Of course, when I got that and the timing, I asked God, I said, is this what I am supposed to be doing, is to help others? And I believe that that's what my mission is. And to make it a little stronger here is that a week later, I had been given an opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. to speak to the representatives in Washington, D.C. That doesn't fall in your lap. That had to have a lot of help. Some of the things that I had when I was going through your bill, I don't claim to understand the whole bill. One of the parts that I really emphasize is the fact of meeting, push your representatives of different areas in the state so you understand that there's a difference in the medical facilities and services that are available. And that is one of the issues I see that you're addressing, and I'm very glad to see that. Because meeting with the doctors, the hospitals, the clinics, the pharmacists in those areas, the needs can be so different because of what's available to them. And I'm hoping that you, I see that in the bill that you are addressing some of that, and I'm glad to see that. And I'm getting a little nervous here.
Oh, well, Jean, just take your time. And maybe would it be easier if maybe I prompted you with a question? You said you had some ideas for maybe making things more efficient or effective.
Yes, some of the, having been in accounting, I know there's budget shortfalls, and I know there is some waste. Now, I'm not saying you guys are out there wasting tons of money, but there are some examples in my letter there. You have to excuse the flow of some of it, because some of it is for the media. Some of it was to be faxed back to Washington, D.C. for some of the things that I was scheduling there. But anyway, regular accounting processes need to be put in place. I don't know the total accounting system that the state has. My sister was in accounting in the state of California for just a short period of time, and the things that she saw were double billing. Invoices would come through, the company would send through, nobody would verify whether the services or the products were rendered. And the companies got real smart. They learned how to just do another invoice numbering so it doesn't jive with another one, and they were just getting paid. They weren't being validated. That can add up to a lot of dollars. And some simple regular accounting processes, the regular steps that need to be taken, there could be funds there that would at least be available.
Okay.
You know, I know that it's not all the money you need, but, you know, if we can work on these problems, that it can possibly help. I've heard people out in the world here saying about all the money that's wasted in our Senate, and I know that that's not totally true. I know, you know, and an audit, I've heard people say, well, what about an audit? An audit does not address that. What an audit addresses, because I've been in audits with companies, they're only looking at cash in, cash out. If you've got the invoices backing your money, you've got going out, that's what they're looking at. They're not looking if you're being double billed. They're not going through all that. And so, you know, that's something I hope that you guys will take. And it's funny because usually I have a 45-minute spot talk, and I can tell I'm already running out here.
Well, that's all right.
No, I mean, but I'm not sure I'm hitting all the key points here.
Well, we do have your written testimony, so just the highlight. What would you consider the key points of your written testimony?
I think the main thing, of course, is like I was saying about the doctors and the different areas getting the proper services available for your different areas in our state. The other one I was looking at here on your bill, Section 7, and then, and I also said in one of your meetings about the drug possibly being buy in bulk. I think that's a very good idea. Having been in business, I understand they're going to get the dollars to be, go a lot farther. But one of the things I'm concerned about is when I was in the meeting and overheard them discussing that, I am on a medication that only, I have an illness that only 1 in 1 million people have, one of my illnesses. That is why one of my shots is $2,000 a month that I do each day. That is not going to be something that you would be able to get in a bulk because you don't have enough patients to, you know, warrant it. And so I'm hoping that those types of situations are not overlooked. Because okay. I'm not the only person, and there's, I'm sure there's several with other ailments that are, again, such a rarity. So that's one issue that I hope you really keep in mind, not to overlook that issue.
Okay.
A couple other things is, one of the major issues that we problem that we came up with when my doctor, like I said, they didn't even know where to get me help. One of the things that has been done after I spoke to a representative several weeks ago was that they get the list of the pharmaceuticals, the medications that they supply, and the numbers, and get these to the people that needed them to help their patients. And I am glad to see that it did get that. In fact, I received one of the first copies of it. And so I want to commend you on that. That is very important. And there are still so many people out there, though, that need some way to go and get the information and the help. And I honestly can't come up with a total thing except that maybe there needs to be some sort of education program. I believe education is the key in everything. And I'm not talking about education of you guys. I'm talking education of our public. Our public does not understand that people like myself are not freeloaders. I did not sit on the system. And unfortunately, I think that Bill 28, one of the reasons that that failed was because the public, the voters, don't understand how you get here. They think that they were voting for people that have lived off the system all their life, never did nothing, laid around, or lazy, and they won the dollars. They need to be taught that's not the case. I worked all my life. I went to college. I raised my children. I would not be on disability if I could work because I was able to make over $30,000 a year. Why would I live this way when I could have, you know? But one of the real things that has to be done is education. And like I say, I'm working on this as well as the federal level. And I feel that is the key to the success for you to accomplish this, is somehow maybe get a media situation to do some of the education out there.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. And if you think of something else, feel free to send us a letter or an email.
Thank you for allowing me.
Oh, yes, Representative Bates.
Gene, thank you for coming. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of your statements was rather interesting to me. You said that Mr. Waxman was supportive of the plan. 10 years ago, he was the most violent opponent that we had in Congress, so he's come around a long ways. How has it been for you trying to get the drugs and medication you needed? I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has stepped up and really tried to help us out here with programs for people. They're all separate companies, so naturally many of the programs are different, and it's difficult for physicians and patients to kind of get lined up and get this thing rolling.
Right.
And physicians feel that somewhat they haven't got the time to do this. They're trying to see their patients and take care of their patients. It's been difficult for them. But I think I think it seems to be getting better. I just wonder what your perception of it was as far as a patient's concerned. Is it easier to get into the programs, get what you need, or is it getting more difficult?
When this happened. Yes, that was a real issue because I know that some people fell through the cracks because of not having, like I said, the people there to help them. And that was a very serious thing. I'm sure there's been several deaths. You've heard reports on the media. We all have. And there's not saying that that couldn't have happened, whether this happened or not. I mean, we don't know that. But the education and getting the help for the people is essential. And I wish I could do more to help. I'm trying. But I am part of the education program that I am trying to do is also to make the public understand that you guys didn't create this. You're trying to fix this. And so, you know, and I know you probably hear an awful lot of gripes and complaints rather than, you know, being told, we know you're doing a good job, that you're trying. And I was just going to real quick, let me look real quick here. There was another thing that I was thinking about. You know that they have, you'll see in the letter there about the research programs. There are, somebody says, well, OHSU has some, but they're not the only ones. There are other research programs out there, but the public, or they, even the doctors and hospitals, don't know all of the programs that are out there. If you could get, somehow, get a list of the types of programs that are available. The research programs can help alleviate a little bit of the budget funds because they provide the medical attention, they provide the medication, they monitor it. Obviously, not everybody is able to be part of that, but the numbers that could be can alleviate some of the stress on the budget itself, too. And I feel that that's a program that would really be effective as soon as you could get one available.
Thank you. Okay, Angela Kimball from National Alliance of Mentally Ill.
Representative March and members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Oregon. And I just wanted to make a few comments. First, we deeply appreciate the knowledge that this body has been showing in terms of mental illnesses and the devastating effects they have upon our family members and, in fact, this entire state. And we truly do appreciate the efforts you have made to incorporate the concerns of our families into the work that you're doing. And what I'd like to point out is that in the last 2 months, our organization has had over a one-third increase in the number of calls to our organization. And those calls have changed dramatically. There are no longer calls asking for help in navigating the system and help in knowing where to turn to for help. But instead, we're getting calls of desperation. We're getting calls from people who are saying, there is nowhere else to turn. Please help us. What can you do? We have no more housing. We have no more medications. This is taking a tremendous toll on our families and on our entire organization of advocacy. In fact, we've been struggling with the deaths of a couple of our family members. And as you move forward with your work, we'd like you to understand that while many of our family members are categorically eligible, there are many thousands who are not. The very nature of some of our mental illnesses are such that some of our family members refuse to go on disability. They refuse to know or acknowledge that they're ill. And many are not eligible because they are simply first experiencing the devastating effects of their mental illness. The process to become categorically eligible by becoming eligible for disability can take a year or more. In the meantime, we have people who are not covered. We understand that you're facing difficult decisions and that these are devastating times, and we just ask that you remember that these are devastating times for our families as well. And lastly, we simply ask that you include us in the prescription coverage piece. We appreciate your concern and your willingness to cover mental health medications. And we know that you're struggling with both logical and fair methods of controlling those costs. I'd like to conclude by saying that many of our family members are neither logical or rational. And some of those choices that seem obvious to others in terms of managing medications are simply impractical and unresponsive for our families. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Greenlee.
I really would like to touch on this last point that you made. It's an interesting way, like the see if I can phrase the question in a way that makes sense. Your advocates argue, as I argue, I hope convincingly, that mental illness is a chronic relapsing brain disorder, and therefore requires parity in its treatment with diabetes and hypertension and lots of other diseases, because by its nature it's the same as those. Now, you carry that, but then you say on the other hand, well, but that's not really true when it comes to prescriptions, because it's really different than anything else and can't be treated the same way. I wonder how you reconcile those two compelling positions.
That's an excellent question or comment, and the way I reconcile it is it's in my daily life. I understand that mental illness is a chronic and recurring illness for many people, such as my son, who has bipolar disorder. He will likely struggle throughout his life. The piece of it that you're talking about is how should we address medications, and why would we not prescribe the same methodology that we would for other illnesses that we, quote, call physical. And from a medical point of view, I would say, yes, there's no reason not to treat mental illnesses any differently. I would absolutely agree. But what I can say is that with my son, the second time he went into his psychiatrist recommended a drug called Ritalin. And my little 12-year-old about ripped out his throat and said, you will not blankety-blank with my head. The doctor said, no problem. I don't want to mess with your head. It's the last thing I want to do. By the way, have you ever heard of Dexedrine? And my son said, no. What does that do? That night, we went home with a prescription for Dexedrine. And my son took it. And the next morning, after one day at school, said, Mama, my head doesn't hurt anymore. I never knew it hurt. I just wanted to slug people all day long. So for me, the way I relate that to the idea of restricting access to mental health medications is that Ritalin would have been a very logical first line of choice for my son, given no background in any kind of medications, no contraindications for taking that medication, other than an explosive response based on his idea that Ritalin was for kids who are messed up. But Dexedrine, being a drug he'd never heard of, seemed okay to take. He's 100% compliant with the four medications he takes, as well as bipolar disorder and his ADD. I consider that well worth the cost of the Dexedrine over Ritalin, which could have caused him to simply reject mental health medications altogether. So that's my response.
May I follow that up a little bit? Whose chair here, Phil?
No,
you be
back.
Careful.
All right.
When things get easier, he'll be chair again.
But you know, all you're saying is that treating patients takes skill. I mean, if we talk about diabetes, we have exactly the same thing when a patient comes in and the doctor says, you know, you check your lab results and you obviously have diabetes and I think you should be on insulin 3 times a day. And if he says, no way, I'm not going to inject myself. And in order to treat a diabetic properly, you need to get their buy-in. You need to be working with them. You need to try different things. What causes me some problems, and I'd really like you from the mom, is that the assumption that there's no way to treat patients with mental illness in a empathetic, rational way that takes their needs and desires into account, but still has in the back of the mind the notion of using evidence and using a variety of other things to move that forward. And I, you know, it's just that. Sort of like you to explore that just a little bit, if you would.
I think most NAMI members do, and in fact the organization does support the efforts to educate physicians as well as to explore other options that increase the efficacy of care. and some of those acknowledge the fact that over half of our psychiatric medications are actually prescribed by PCPs. And in that regard, you know, we support the education of the providers who sometimes don't provide in a way that we think is consistent with the best quality of care. We certainly look favorably at any efforts to control polypharmacy, prescribing two or more antipsychotics or two or more antidepressants or more than four psychotropic drugs at the same time, and a number of other methods that other states around the country have used to not focus on the cost containment so much of medications, but rather ensure that the best quality of care is being given and that that, in most cases, one would assume, would result in cost-effective care when you're doing the best quality in a mental illness. I have no problems with that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Very articulate.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Mike Volpe. Representative Greenlick, could you give up your mic?
Not a chance.
The mic. You will give up your mic. Thank you, Mike, for coming in, because I've been trying to get it away from you. Oh, you can move over one.
Representative March, the rest of the committee, my name is Mike Volpe. I was here last Friday, I think, and so I just want to make a few quick comments. I had a chance to kind of think about my thoughts a little bit. And I think one thing that I want to address is the fact that I believe that Representative Bates, you mentioned the possible choice between going to the alternative that is mentioned in HB 3624, or perhaps having to go to 100% of SSI. And correct me if I'm wrong, if I misunderstood your comments.
Mr. Chair? Mike, I'm not sure I know exactly what you're talking about here. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, when I mentioned the fact that some of the measurements in House Bill 3624 would make receiving care very difficult for people who do receive care simply because of the cost-containing measures that were contained in that bill. And then I believe that you mentioned that certain cost-cutting measures were necessary to try to meet the parameters of the budget.
I think what we're talking, Mr. Chair, I think what we're talking about here is we want to contain costs in certain areas but not deny people basic care, because if we don't do that, we're going to have large segments of the population who presently receive care won't receive any care at all. And we also want to be certain that those people receiving care get durable medical goods, pharmaceuticals, A&D treatment, which at the present time in our present budget we won't have money for if we don't do these things. It's not aimed at denying care to anybody. It's trying to expand care to more people so we can buy back those populations we've lost or are at risk of losing July 1st.
But I will be, and well, I will end up losing some care options. And I mean, I do not feel that I use care inefficiently, even though I do receive fee for service. And I think that I do maintain a minimum of doctor visits just because I don't want to go to the doctor any more than anyone else does. And I do feel that it's a very high priority to be able to have the doctor of my choice. And this, I don't believe, would be possible under a fee-for-service type option, also it may make it very difficult for me to try to secure pharmaceutical prescriptions in my own community, which is Corvallis, if, you know, the average wholesale price is lowered any more than it already has been. And whether that would happen under this plan, I really don't know. I'm also legally blind, which makes it very difficult for me to try to intake large amounts of written information. I have to try to remember everything, and so I'm only capable of remembering so much. But I think those are the comments that I wanted to make, that to try to consider all the options. And I did bring up raising revenue, and there are a number of different ways that that can be done, but I don't know if there is any measure being taken to look at possibilities of trying to raise revenue. It seems like you're much more about cutting costs than raising revenue, and my fear is that all of the cost cutting that's taken will end up costing the state more money in the long run, and sooner or later, well, we're not going to be left with much of a system at all, because there are certain cuts being made this term. Already, six levels of long-term care have been cut. The medically needy, the GA, have been cut. We've got general assistance, and probably a good 20-25% of the people receiving help through seniors and people with disabilities have been cut out. And there doesn't seem to be any possibility that the revenue situation will improve anytime soon. What will be the alternative in the future? More cuts? How far can we go?
Well, we can't go much further. If we go any further in cuts, we won't have a Medicaid program basically at all. So that we're trying to make the program as streamlined as we can and encourage more doctors and providers to be involved with the program, make it function so that they will be involved. And so in a case of where your doctor may not be working currently with a fully capitated health plan, we would like to encourage them to do so. And if we can do that, then you would still have your options. But we've also talked and heard from a number of people about having an exception category for those who don't fit, into the plans that way. So we will look at that. And Representative Bates,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Mike, you and I know each other from elsewhere, and I appreciate who you are and what you do. And I can understand why people in the health plan, and especially people who are vulnerable, have great fears about what this committee is doing, and I understand that. We are not trying to hurt anybody. We are trying to maintain a program for people like yourself that you can get the medications you need, see the doctors you want to see and need to see. We recognize there are some very special people in the Oregon Health Plan that need specialized care, and I believe that flexibility will ultimately be built into this bill. People like yourself have long-term relationships with physicians that you really don't want to lose, and I understand that. You also mentioned that about 25% you thought of people who used to be in the plan may lose the plan entirely, and that's what we're concerned about too. We need a plan that is efficient as we possibly can make it without hurting people, so that we can buy back those people who will be completely left outside the plan. We don't want those people out there. They need to be in the plan, too. So our first goal is to get as much efficiency as we can without hurting people, and then, if possible, with new revenue, expand the plan. I'm not guaranteeing that revenue will happen, but at least we can buy back a great deal of what we're talking about through efficiencies and being careful, but not hurting people at the same time. And I believe we can do both of those.
I would say trying to streamline the plan somewhat maybe a very effective way to raise some revenue, and then I think that alternate methods to try to raise revenue will also be necessary to basically streamline other parts of the economy, such as tax breaks, such as decoupling from the federal legislation, things like that that may help Oregon to survive. Because I was at a national conference which was held in Oregon about 4 years ago, and several people who had no knowledge of me whatsoever came up and said how lucky you are to live in the state of Oregon. I truly hope that people will continue to say the same thing. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any questions? Nope. Thank you very much for coming, Mike. Okay. And next, Lynn Reed, OMAP.
More paper, but this time all it does is have the right letterhead.
So the content is superfluous?
Tell me you didn't change that.
I thought Kilingowski had been impeached, and I just missed it.
Got the other guy out of retirement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Reed, the administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. I did come before your committee last week and introduce into the written record written testimony on the bill and offered to come back and go through that testimony today. I'm here for that purpose. I do understand that the bill is evolving or will be evolving in terms of some changes to the bill. But since our department will have the primary responsibility for implementing the changes that come out from this bill, wanted to be sure that you were aware of any concerns that we had related to the bill as introduced and maybe identify some possible unintended consequences from some aspects of the bill. And also to address the overall intent of the bill, which we understand is to build upon the fully capitated health plan and other managed care plans that we have in place today to move forward towards enrolling more of our Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program clients in managed care, which we fully support. Also to move forward in terms of having fully capitated health plans manage some of the services that are provided to clients in our open card or fee-for-service delivery system, which we are also supportive in terms of coordination of care, in terms of the benefits that we get from managed care for access, quality improvement, and in addition aspects of the bill which get at the issue of cost containment. Which we recognize is very important to ensure the long-term sustainability of the plan. I don't intend to go through every point that's in here, which I'm sure you will be appreciative of, but do want to touch on the highlights, the general comments, and then some of the specific bullet points in the written testimony. One of our first concerns with the bill at a high level is that we believe that many aspects of the bill will require amendments to our demonstration or operational protocol changes or state plan amendment changes. These are all...
Representative Bates.
I didn't mean to cut you off mid-sentence. Finish and ask my question.
All three of these are things that would require approval from the federal government.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Clearly, the movement of the line would require not a change of the waiver, but at least we'd have to have approval from CMS to do that, and we understand that. The rest of the things in the plan, I'm not a lawyer, but we've checked with LC, and there's a difference of opinion here. We cannot find statute in federal law or in the waiver itself that would require what we perceive to be a need for change in waiver on the rest of the bill as presently stated or potentially in the future. If you could give us that, the actual statutes that you think require a waiver, we would like to see those so we can respond to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I'll be glad to have staff go through and identify those things. I think for the most part you won't see them as statutory references. The way in which the demonstration approval process works is we submit an application for a demonstration. The federal government, in approving that demonstration, is approving the program that we described in our application. And then to that, they also attach some, they waive some federal regulations for specific purposes, and they attach terms and conditions to the demonstration. They also require us to have what are called operational protocols, which describe how we operate the program. And one of the terms and conditions, for example, requires us to go back to the federal government to make changes to the operational protocols in order to do business, to operate the program differently than what was originally approved. So it's that sort of activity that we would be identifying.
Mr. Chair.
Follow.
Lynn, as I read the bill and think about the bill and the policy behind the bill, there's no significant, from my mind, change in what we're doing other than we're expanding one part of the plan, managed care primarily, and contracting another part of the plan, fee-for-service. I would still like to see, if they're not statute and regulations you're concerned about, parts of the waiver you might be concerned about specifically, because I really don't follow the train of thought. We're not making a massive change from the point of view of what we're asking to do. We are making a significant change on the thrust of how we want to manage people. Now, the area of managed care, even though it's going to be limited for fee-for-service by the plans, a lot of which your department may have been doing in the past, is potentially a policy change that I'd be interested in seeing if you're concerned about. But I would really like to see the regulations and the specs. I just have a hard time believing, and I may be wrong, that the feds are setting up a program that says if you move from 70% to 80% or 90% of managed care, you have to get a waiver from us. I just don't follow the reasoning or policy there. So if you can bring that to us specifically so we can look at it, it would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, actually I'm not sure who Mr. Chair is here, sorry.
I'm Mr. Potato Head, he's Mr. Chair.
We'll be glad to do that, for example, moving from 70% to 80% managed care enrollment, that isn't the issue. And we'll go through and identify those areas where and why we think it is that it will require federal approval.
Mr. Chair, yeah. No, and when you do that, I would really like to see citing the actual regulation so we can look at it ourselves. People interpret these things differently, and we want to be sure we're looking at the same language. This statement by your department that we're concerned about this is great, but I'd like to see what's backing that up so we can look at it ourselves, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, we'll be glad to do that. I just want to make sure you understand that in many cases it's not going to be the regulations that we cite. It'll be a term and condition and operational protocol.
Mr. Chair, that'd be great. Okay. Whatever you're basing your decision interpretation on is what we want to see.
Representative Westland.
In the interest of time, I think Alan fleshed the issue out well enough. We would appreciate that, Lynn. We are not only concerned but perplexed with the emphasis you put on the additional CMS approvals we would need to do to implement what, as Representative Bates says, is functionally a shift from managed or fee-for-service into managed care. So, I think we fleshed this issue out enough, but it's an important one. So if you could get that to us as soon as possible, that would be greatly appreciated.
We'll do that. Moving on, just a continuation of that point, which we'll come back to when we provide the information for you, is that in some cases, should we be correct that it requires approval by CMS, and should that approval not be forthcoming, we'd like to see some provision for how we would operate the program if that were the case. Also, we think it's important that the bill in terms of its effective date, perhaps have some kind type of an operational date that takes into consideration that there are development and implementation activities that would need to occur in order to implement some components of the bill. In addition, think that it might be valuable if there were some way to address the issue of if it turns out that some of the provisions are more costly to the state, do we want to be locked into those provisions should that be the case, or would you want to see perhaps some method in which we could bring that back to the emergency board if we should identify a situation? An example there might be one of the provisions of the bill would have the fully capitated health plans managing the fee for service or open card prescription drugs. It is our hope that we'll be able to get approval for that to occur and that it would not provide a roadblock to obtaining the federal rebates. But should that not be the case, we wouldn't want to be locked in to that from a statutory perspective is our thinking.
Representative Bates.
The example you took was a good one, except it's probably not going to be in the bill anyway, but that's a good one because it's crisp and you can look at it. I assume your agency feels that going back for e-board approval is an adequate way for oversight to change statutory language or to change emphasis if it's in the bill. I'm a little concerned about the possibility of a conflict between the executive branch and the legislative branch and these kind of issues. Have you discussed that with your counterparts in the governor's office?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, not specifically. This testimony has been shared with the governor's office, but we haven't specifically talked about this issue.
I can't speak for others, but for myself, that type of permissive language, if it came back to e-board, would be adequate from my point of view. But we don't want to change the thrust of the bill itself by doing that. But having some accountability and oversight from that point of view, I would not be opposed to, if it's not a constitutional problem.
Moving on, well, the last bullet point there under general was just a comment that there may be some aspects, the very next bullet in Section 1 would be one example, where it's possible that the bill could unintentionally constrain managed care enrollment, and I know that isn't the intent, and just wanted to point out, for example, putting in statute that basically capacity would be defined by being able to assign an enrollee to a primary care physician within 21 days of enrollment might be more restrictive actually than what we use today. Today we look generally at the 30-day time period, and so just want to point that out to you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative West.
Could we back up a couple bullet points, Lynn? Says this bill does not appear to address federal and state requirements related to contracting. Aren't federal and state requirements related to contracting part of the public body of law well known? I mean, should we include every reference to every contractual change we want to make in specific law regarding that contract? Is, I mean, what are you trying to get at here?
Representative Westland, that is an ambiguous statement. What I had intended to convey was that, in particular, there's a section later on that's dealing with the actuary and rate setting process that talks about the selection process. And that process appears to be if there's an impasse between the department and managed care plan representative, fully capitated health plan representatives in terms of the selection, that it would then be turned over to the Secretary of State to make that choice. And our concern there is that there is a competitive procurement process that we go through today, at least in terms of how we secure vendors, that has a scoring mechanism that is a piece of it, and we're not allowed to ultimately make the subjective choices. And it is the applicant who has the highest score who ultimately comes out as the winner of the contract, and sometimes that takes into account the pricing component as well as substantive components of the bid. And so that's our concern. That also was a concern in terms of whether or not that would be satisfactory to the federal government. But it's not something that we have explored yet. It's just mentioned as a possibility.
Well, I think you're referring to Section 8, and
yes.
Regardless of who selects, the actuary, OMAP would still be responsible for the contracting thereof. But having said all that, Section 8 is one of those film at 11 sections, so that's currently undergoing a finer microscope. So, but anyway, I appreciate you fleshing that out.
Thank you. The last bullet on page 2 I wanted to touch on is the issue I think that you've had some discussion already, and that's related to whether or not the bill would allow for some flexibility in terms of who might be exempted from enrolling in a fully capitated health plan. As we read the bill as written, as introduced, it would appear that if there was capacity to serve the area by fully capitated health plans, everyone would be required to enroll. And we have identified on page 10, that's attachment A, some of the exemptions that are currently in place for fully capitated health plan and other enrollment that we think are valid considerations in terms of looking at how this bill would be laid out.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda's going to be a back and forth obviously today, so bear with us. I do appreciate your time. The discussion about capacity, which at first seemed the simplest of things, took about a week, about 5 or 6 hours a day or more, and we ended up with something that I don't think any of us felt completely comfortable with.
15.
And as we went through that discussion, we kept finding out more and more about what the word capacity meant to different groups. Everything from 21 days to being assigned, 14 days to being assigned, to 30 days to being assigned, to not being assigned at all and being an assignment pool, that when you had a need, you would be assigned. What we're trying to do is balance a situation which capacity is meaningful, that plans are not signing up people they can't take care of, but at the same time, the people are not being blocked being signed up because the definition of capacity is something that's unrealistic. By that I mean, if you are assigned to a physician via a commercial product, you cannot expect to call a physician and immediately get history and physical done within a week or two. It'll probably take months. On the other hand, if you call up and need emergent care, you should be seen that day or the next day. Or if it's a true emergency, be referred to the emergency room. Those are the kind of things we're trying to balance in this language. We probably haven't done the best of jobs yet. We also know there are people that probably should be exempt. But to build that flexibility is very, very difficult without ending up in a situation where we are now, where we clearly have people in counties that should be inside a plan. There's capacity in that plan, and they've been assigned to fee-for-service by caseworkers. We're trying to get around that and at the same time balance all this out. And I think you understand that, trying to work with us too. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, certainly that has been an issue, has been identified as an issue. One example of a way in which might think about addressing that is whether or not it would be appropriate through a budget note or through a bill, is that right now we have for certain segments of our population, the exception process is indeed driven by the field worker. Now, it may be possible that having a centrally operated exception process would get to that issue of consistent application of appropriate exceptions. And we do some central exemptions for a portion of the population, but not the most needy and vulnerable population that is handled in the field by the caseworkers.
I understand that. Possibly you could even suggest some language to us that might be helpful to that. And also, I would appreciate, you mentioned federal regulations this bill may be breaking if we don't adjust that language. If you could reference that, those specific regulations you're concerned about, that would be helpful for us in working on the capacity discussion.
Thank you.
Representative Cruz?
Yeah, kind of following up on Representative Bates. Clearly, there's some carve outs that we need to make and need to reference someplace, simply because I think it's appropriate that the state assumes the risk for those. And I would second what Representative Bates said about getting us some more definitive language there. But I'd also like, if you know where the specific reference is to American Indian and Alaskan Natives, I would like to know where that is, because we've had some discussions with Legislative Council on that, and they can't find it. So if you know where it is, we'd sure like to know where it is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we'll be glad to look at identifying those sites or regulations to you. And in many cases, in most cases, I think it would be true to say that the exceptions to managed care enrollment that are here now are not ones that are mandated by the federal government. They are policy choices that have been made working with the health plans, working with the participants. For example, I believe, although our expert isn't here for me to have checked before I came over, but the American Indian, Alaska Native exception is one where we have government-to-government relations, and I believe that's one that's been negotiated in terms of our relationships with the tribes. And so it's those sorts of things that will pull that information together for you.
And Ms. Chair, we just need the site on that. But I mean, clearly groups like medically fragile, high risk, there are clearly some things as a matter of policy that we as the state assume the risk for, and we just need to be a little more definitive in our language relative to those populations.
Representative Weston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lynn, would you consider this list of exceptions to be complete?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, I don't believe it is complete. One of the things that crossed my mind the other day after I had submitted the testimony was an exception that is related to end-stage renal disease. In the Medicare program, when someone joins an HMO, if they have end-stage renal disease at the time they join the plan, they're not actually put into the plan. And so we mirrored that policy at the request of our managed care plans. And so that's another exception that isn't here. There may be some others like that. That's the only one that's crossed my mind right now.
Well, if you could get us that list, because as you can obviously tell, I mean, we have an appetite up here to include, you know, some exceptions and probably most of these. We just want to make sure it's the right list when we get to the final product, which is going to be very quickly. If I could have a follow-up, Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Chair.
Please.
Four bullets up. Clients with challenging behavior that plans do not want to serve. Can't they opt out of serving them already? Isn't there a process already in place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, there is a process in place, but that process is an exception process to the requirement that someone join be enrolled in a fully capitated health plan. We do have areas of the state which are required mandatory fully capitated health plan enrollment unless you meet exception criteria. And so this would be an example of someone who was enrolled to begin with, but most likely was disenrolled because of the challenging behavior issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Lynn, you're one of the most knowledgeable people about the Oregon Health Plan and about eligibility for Medicaid, about eligibility for fee-for-service and managed care. And I appreciate your expertise in helping us do this. But I would point out, Mr. Chair, that if Al Bates, Lynn Reed, Ben Westland can't figure out something like this, how do we expect a caseworker, all the work he or she has to do, to make a reasonable decision on placing someone in fee-for-service or managed care? And I think that tells me why this bill is important. If we can get definitive language here that will help those people make those decisions, I think we made a big step forward. So they have something they can really base their decisions on and feel comfortable making those decisions and maybe more efficient in making them. I would hate to be a caseworker, not be a physician, maybe only have minimal training, making minimal wage, trying to make these kind of decisions for patients. And that's basically what's happening, I think. So with all due respect, I think the conversation and nailing these exceptions down is extremely important. Yep. One we should put in the bill and make sure it happens. So the information you bring to us about what you think those exemptions should be is extremely important. I look forward to seeing that list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates. We certainly will devote an appropriate amount of attention to the importance of the task in doing that.
Mr. Chair, I think I'd also point out Representative Westland's reference to challenge behaviors probably is an outlier to that process, because most of these categories, I think, can be fairly well defined as to how you would qualify, but that one is a little bit mushy. So with the understanding that that's kind of maybe a separate set all by itself.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's correct. Many of these exceptions are an administrative rule in worker guides, and we'll pull information from there as we try to help craft some language that may be workable for you.
Yeah, and with the intent. And I guess, Mr. Chair, with understanding that these are an administrative rule, but they're still, at this point in time, very cumbersome, and there's got to be a cleaner way to make the determination than what we have. So,
Representative Westland.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think a good chair at this point in time would be saying something like, get us the damn list, we'll hash it out.
Bring us the ORs.
Yeah.
Got the ORs.
Yeah, thank you.
Message received. Moving on, going back to page 3, just wanted to comment here, and I don't think this was one of the intended consequences, the second bullet down, that as we read the plain language of the bill, we thought that it would not provide flexibility to enroll individuals in dental care organizations or mental health organizations if the area was served by a fully capitated health plan. And I've since heard that's not the intent. In Section 4...
And if I could agree with you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do think the bill needs to be cleaned up on this point, because we've had several questions, and it's... I mean, this is a language issue, and we want to be as clear as we can possibly be. So I think that's a good catch.
Okay. Under Section 4, the last bullet on that page 3, in that particular bullet, you were describing the physician care organizations and in that section of the bill, and talking about a couple of the items that PCOs would be required to cover would be prescription drugs and outpatient chemical dependency services, and that they would not be able to cover outpatient hospital services. We've had extensive experience with PCOs, which we started back in 1985 in the state, and we were leaders in the nation with that program. And we had a lot of flexibility in the benefit design. At times, that benefit design did not include prescription drugs, did not include chemical dependency, and that was a good thing from the perspective of going into a community where physicians weren't contracting with us and they didn't want to take on risk for some of those kinds of services. And instead, they stayed focused on the risk under the PCO being physician, lab, and X-ray, and outpatient hospital for the physician, lab, and X-ray component, in order to keep that focus to not wanting to shift care where there wasn't risk. And so just thought you might want to be aware that previously we have flexibility in the benefit design here. The real key was inpatient hospital wasn't a part of the PCO, and otherwise it was pretty open and flexible.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Bates.
Lynn, I appreciate bringing that to our attention. Frankly, I had not completely considered outpatient hospital services being under the auspices of a PCO, and obviously you're correct, that could happen. I'm still a little concerned that we not make the language too permissive in that we set up PCOs that are a little more than fee-for-service organizations, but the PCOs at least as a minimum would require a physician to be at risk for their own services, and then the rest of it be permissive. Would that be something that would be similar to what you had before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, it would that would be even fewer services than what we had before. The most minimal package that we had when we operated a PCO was physician, lab, X-ray, an outpatient hospital, physician, lab, and X-ray. And then the so physician lab X-ray services provided in an outpatient hospital setting were part of the risk for the PCO. But if the statute was just physician, that would be fine if it allowed for flexibility to add the additional services.
Okay. We'll talk later.
Okay.
Thanks.
Moving on to page 4, section 6. This is the component of the bill that deals with the fully capitated health plans managing certain services for fee-for-service clients in those areas where we have fee-for-service or for those clients that might be exempted from FCHP enrollment. And this would have a similar set of issues that there were no exemptions allowed for the FCHP handling those services, and it may be appropriate to look at similar exemptions to those discussed for FCHP enrollment. Another component, when I talked about the possibility that that the bill doesn't allow for this arrangement perhaps not being the most cost beneficial for the state. And we've talked about that briefly before, that there may be some mechanism that would allow for that issue to be addressed. One bullet here is intended to address the issue of mental health drugs, excluding the including antidepressants, basically in Section 6, the FCHPs are viewed as the entity most appropriate to manage mental health drugs other than the antipsychotics. And there's a lot of work that's been going on in terms of how the fully capitated health plans and the mental health organizations can work together to manage those drugs for patients. And the bill assumes that that's most effectively done through the FCHP side, and would just like to say there may be some other options there that are more locally community-driven and more integrated. And I think some of those are in the process of being presented to you. Another comment that we made here is more just a comment, and it's related to the issue of FCHPs managing the outpatient hospital benefit for fee-for-service clients, and a comment that we assume that would also have some component of management, whatever that may be, related to emergency room use. And keeping in mind that these are individuals who are in the open card system who don't have guaranteed access to primary care and specialty services. And for some, the fee-for-service delivery system and emergency rooms may be the only access that they have. And that may or may not be appropriate, but if we haven't provided a system for them to have access to the basic physician care, we need to figure out how we're going to handle payment for their claims when they do access the emergency rooms.
Mr. Chair. Representative Bates.
Lynn, I want to discuss this more fully with you. As I read the bill, fully capitated health plans wouldn't limit service. They might limit payment for services, which is a big difference. They're not going to tell an emergency room, you can't see this patient. That's going to be a decision in the emergency room by the physician and by the client at that time. So, first off, I don't think they have the power to say to someone, you're not going to be seen there. I've never seen that happen in 25 or 30 years of medicine, okay? So, number one, they're not going to limit service. They may limit payment for that service and how much that payment is. If they think the bill's inappropriate, it's too high, they might be cutting that bill down. Or they might say, this patient had an opportunity to go to a safety net clinic, had a chance to go to a fast-track clinic. That opportunity the patient chose not to take, and then they might say that they would not pay that bill. I think that it is an area that's going to be difficult for us, but to get some control on the overuse of emergency rooms, especially in the setting of the times we're in right now, is going to be very important. I think the bill does that. I'm not sure that I completely agree with you that taking that away is going to help us. I just don't see how it's going to stop the care. I do see how it might cut the cost down. We possibly could retrain some people and give them other opportunities. Admitting that if there's no capacity, it's much more difficult, and you obviously can't say no to a service that's been received, even if it isn't emergent, if there's no other option available. But the cost of that should also be something reasonable, not a $400 or $500 bill for an earache, which should have been $67 or $80. There may be a difference here in Paul's between you and I, but from where I see it, where the rubber hits the road, I think that's a reasonable thing that we're asking them to do. And they're not at risk for it. The biggest problem here I see is that if we're going to give them a fee for doing this, there's some oversight by your department to make sure, again, that it's cost-effective. They are saving us enough money without hurting patient care, that we're getting we want to get out of this as far as cost savings is concerned for the fee we'd give them for doing that. But they're not at risk. They're not in a position to deny services to people based solely on trying to save money. And they can't stop that service anyway. They're going to be reviewing those bills afterwards. Would you agree with what I've said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, yes, I do. And I apologize if I've used inappropriate words here in terms of denying service. I do understand that the issue here is denying payment for service, and do also recognize that that's one of the areas where we don't have controls built into our fee-for-service open card system, and that there is certainly opportunity to make appropriate decisions in terms of payment. It will just be a challenge for us to find that right path to doing that.
Okay. Representative Westland and Representative Merkley.
Merkley is his name. He's new, but you'll get to know him after a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you brought this paragraph up. I think this, in many ways, characterizes exactly what this bill is all about and exactly what we're trying to get our arms around here, and that is additional management of medical services provided in this state, and how, because we have a belief that managed care has demonstrably proven itself over a number of years through differing economies, through different types of environments, and this paragraph, and for those of you out in the audience that have a copy of this, I think the first line should have in it, FCHIPS could potentially deny services for fee-for-service clients, just to clarify, this is what this bill is all about, and how we get a better handle, you know, around managing part of this fee-for-service population is what we need your help with, but what we're trying to do.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Okay. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The paragraph two down at the bottom of page four continues on that theme that Section 6 does not provide access to primary care. Help me with that point. Why wouldn't management of fee-for-service providers include an effort to connect people with primary care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I think that's absolutely what would be ideal, is that if what was encompassed in this was an expectation that the fully capitated health plans would in some fashion help ensure access to primary care, that would be the ideal. That would be what we'd most like to have happen. But I don't see that, at least in our reading of the bill, we didn't see that was the expectation that the fully capitated health plans had to ensure access to primary care. Instead, it was they would be managing certain services, which did not include primary care. It included hospital, inpatient and outpatient, prescription drugs, non-emergency transportation, and durable medical equipment and medical supplies. But that's certainly what we want to work towards, and the increased push and priority for fully capitated health plans or even physician care organizations moves us towards that. that issue of providing access to primary care.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, but you know, Mr. Chair, fee-for-service providers is primary care. So, I mean, you know, what we're driving towards here is we want everybody in the world in managed care. And what Section 6 is talking about is in those rare instances, hopefully, that it's not going to work that way, these are the other options for giving some level of care to those folks. And it's kind of a triage, ending up with ACO is probably the final option here. So, you know, I think Representative Westland's right. This is kind of the meat of the thing is we want primary care to be the best option for both the providers and for the clients. So if people are going to matriculate one way or the other, that's the place they matriculate to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we do understand that as the intent of the bill and our support, definitely are supportive of that intent. Moving on to page 5, just wanted to briefly talk about a couple of issues that may happen with the denial of fee-for-service services for some of our clients. For one thing, the fully capitated health plan would be removed from the care of the individual in the sense that this is a situation where the fully capitated health plan isn't actually providing the primary care or specialty care, and that there is some concern then it's possible there wouldn't be the appropriate incentives to move forward in approving services that were necessary to help return a person home from the hospital or a long-term care setting. And likewise, a follow-through on that is the next bullet. Within the long-term care setting arena, many of the clients who are participating, receiving long-term care services, have higher income than the SSI level. And when they do, they spend, basically, they pay into the system. So to the degree their income is above the SSI level, about 75% of the poverty level, they pay that excess income towards their long-term care. And to the degree, but that excess income has deductions to it. And so to the degree that we deny any services, medically necessary services, that they go ahead and incur, that's a direct offset to the pay-in that they make for their long-term care. And so there are some cost implications there that need to be looked at.
So is there language that you can suggest for that? I mean, you're...
I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chair, but certainly I'll talk to staff about language that might help address that issue.
Representative Greenlick.
The notion of the long-term care payment isn't about these services, though, that's right. It's about other services that are covered in a different section of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, it's brought up here because here are some of the services used by long-term care clients that now may have additional controls, maybe appropriate controls, that would stop us from making payment for those services. The clients may still get the services, and that'll reduce the pay-in for these particular services. But it would be true for other services as well.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oops, I'm sorry.
Were you through?
Yeah, I'm just not sure I understood what you said. I wonder if you could say
it. I'll try.
It's all sounded like English words.
Also a little bit out of my area of expertise here as I move over to the long-term care system. For example, a person receiving long-term care services could have income as high as 300% of the SSI level, around $1,650 a month. The SSI level is $550 a month. So in order for that person to get the long-term care services and then the wraparound Medicaid acute care services that we provide under our program, they have to pay in $1,100.
But are those folks that are qualifying for OHP under this model?
Yes, they are.
Because of the categorical.
They qualify under this model because they're receiving long-term care services. They're below 300% of the SSI level. They pay in. They get the OHP plus medical, acute care medical services. So for that particular example, they would pay in every month $1,100 towards their long-term care benefit. That would entitle them to the long-term care service because they met the criteria for long-term care at the priority level, would entitle them to OHP plus. To the degree they also decide that they need some medical services that now we aren't going to pay for under OHP plus, they can go ahead and purchase them, and then that will reduce that $1,100 pay-in by whatever the amount of the service was.
Well, what's an example of that? I mean, they would come under a fully capitated health plan if they qualified, is that right?
They could. This particular section was dealing with someone who was in the fee-for-service delivery system. But that would be true in the fully capitated health plan as well. An example might be, let's say an individual needed an electric wheelchair. The physician ordered the electric wheelchair. The fully capitated health plan for this fee-for-service client said, I don't think they need this particular electric wheelchair. I mean, that's exactly what you're asking them to look at to evaluate. But if it was ordered, then they could use that. They could go ahead, buy it, and then have that be a deduction to the amount they would pay in for their care.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Concerning this paragraph, I'm just going to kind of, you know, we go back and forth between fee-for-service and capitated care. I think sometimes we kind of lose the logic behind what we're doing, and I think this paragraph may have lost that logic. Okay, let me tell you why. Firstly, timely hospital discharges. Hospitals are being paid far below what their actual costs are for these patients, and trust me, they're tracking them and asking them to go home as quickly as possible. So I don't think from that point of view, hospital discharges are going to be impacted on fee-for-service by putting form of managed care over them. And as far as nursing facilities are concerned, there's no gain or loss from someone who's managing that, whether they stay there or not. They're not capitated. I mean, there's no gain or loss there. Their concern is to produce something as efficient as possible, or they lose their contract potentially and the percentage they're getting for doing that, and your department would be overseeing that. So it kind of goes back to the previous arguments we've had all along, I think, that if there's proper oversight for these people, I don't think that paragraph has any real meaning. That's what your department has to apply. It has to say, yes, we have a fee for doing this, patients are getting better, they're being well treated, and we're doing it in the most efficient way possible. But I don't see there's any gain or loss for them, and that's the way it should be on these situations on fee for service. They don't get a bonus for denying services. They might get themselves in trouble for denying services if they don't get a bonus for it. Okay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I do understand the point that you're making, and certainly it will be very important to us to have the appropriate oversight responsibilities set up in our contracts to address those issues. One comment in the next bullet down was talked about the fully capitated health plans managing for fee-for-service open card clients inpatient and outpatient hospital services. And this is really just a comment that some of those inpatient and outpatient services may be for psychiatric hospitalizations or psychiatric emergency room use. Just some question on whether or not the FCHP is the best entity to manage those kind of services, or whether or not you would want to look to the mental health organization.
Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Westland's always spoken to this. You know, this is something we really appreciate having some extra eyes on. The intent of the bill was not to knock out mental care organizations, mental health organizations. It was meant to deal with primary physical health and those parts of physical health that are taken care of by PCPs. So I think we need a little bit of clarification of language in this issue. I will make sure that happens. Thank you. I think it's the same issue you were talking about earlier.
Thank you. Next bullet deals with non-emergency transportation. I don't know that your intent in writing the bill was to make this particular piece be so broad is all non-emergency transportation as opposed to non-emergency medical transportation. And although, as it relates to non-emergency medical transportation, we do have some concerns which are listed basically in Attachment B, which is on page 12. And it may be that at another time you'd rather have some more detail interaction on the brokerages that we've been engaged in setting up across the state, working with local communities, with the Department of Transportation, that have involved a significant stakeholder participation in building those transportation systems. You would want some great consideration before putting in place, I believe, something that might dismantle or undermine the brokerages that have been set up or are in underway right now.
Well, I think the intent was to medical, and Ellen Lowe brought that to our attention earlier as well. So, great.
All right. Section 8, we briefly talked about before at the beginning. This is the portion of the bill that deals with the actuarial rate setting process, some concerns that we have related to the selection of the actuarial firm I've already talked about. A concern to us is the timing that's laid out in the bill in terms of when various things would occur. We're concerned, given our, at least our current process, that it doesn't quite, the times identified in the bill don't quite allow us enough time to go out, actually select an actuarial firm or have, and then if it's disputed, have that resolved, then go through the execution of a contract. That doesn't happen quickly, even after you've selected the apparent winner, and get that in place, and then have that entity come in, get the required data that they need, and begin the data manipulation. We think that the timelines identified in the bill don't really allow us to meet the requirements that we would have trying to fit the information into the agency request budget and the governor's recommended budget timeframes. So suggest you might want to look at that.
Lynn, we had some discussion. I just want to have a clarification, Mr. Chair, if I could. The contract period for Medicaid waivers, we are currently tied to the federal fiscal year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, our current contracting start period does start with the federal fiscal year, and although it didn't used to, it used to start in July 1, and we said there isn't enough time from the time you finish session and give us a budget to have a contract in place on July 1, so we moved it out to the October 1 date.
Okay, that was it, Mr. Chair, discussion we had as to which is more cumbersome, being tied. I mean, as long as we're tied to one fiscal year or the other, I guess that's appropriate. But we were just wondering at one point whether it would make our math easier if we were tied to our own fiscal year. But
our previous experience with that was that it didn't work well for us at all.
Just because there wasn't enough time for. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
The bill also appears to require that we go through that actuarial selection process on a biennial basis, and you may want some flexibility there that would allow for it to happen, every other biennium perhaps. We think that that allows for some stability in terms of who the firm is, who understands the data and the program needs in developing the rates. The last bullet I want to talk about in that section is really that issue of the potential conflict of interest in terms of providing the FCHPs with what might be almost a veto-like authority in terms of the selection, but we talked a little bit that that may not be the absolute intent here. I do want to say that the current RFP process for the actuary, we do invite some plan participation on the review panel, but they don't have the ability to, in that process, to have a veto vote. It's just a scoring mechanism, and their scores enter into it just like others who are participating on the review panel. Section 9, it was a little bit difficult to understand, but I think what I understood was that it does two things. It says that there are a couple of services that the fully capitated health plans will be capitated for. One of those is the non-emergency medical intended to be medical transportation that we may you may revisit. The other is prescription drugs, including the non-antipsychotic mental health drugs. Now, if it is the intent to put that in statute, that would take away the option that one of the options that's been discussed in the past by the work groups, which was the possibility of carving out prescription drugs from the fully capitated health plan risk, with the idea being that we would hopefully be successful in getting approval to allow the plans to manage the prescription drug use of their enrollees, but have us pay for it on a fee-for-service basis and claim federal rebates. And it seems like this would prohibit that if that's truly what's intended in that section. The other piece that I think that section did was to lock in basically a component of the capitation rates related to hospital services. It was set up, I think, is that the capitation rate would not exceed an unidentified percentage of the fee-for-service rates as it related to the DRG hospitals.
Yeah, I would submit, Ms. Chair, that section, some of these things will be rewritten. That section will probably not even have any of the same words except for some of the adjectives may still be.
We might use the again.
We'll use the. We may use a.
And Section 10 may be similar.
Yes.
Section 10 was the piece dealing with DRG hospitals and setting in statute methodology and in some case more than the methodology for the fee-for-service payment system.
Yeah.
And our biggest concern there probably was on the outpatient rate-setting side, that it would tie us to a percentage of Medicare rates, and that's driven outside of our budget process and might unnecessarily lock us into changes in payments that aren't supported in budget. Section 11 dealt with the pharmacy benefits manager, the PBM. As I understand this, the intent was that the state would contract with a single PBM and we would engage the plans, the fully capitated health plans, we would consult with them in terms of developing the RFP to go out and solicit a PBM. And that PBM would have two lines of business. One would be for our fee-for-service or open card clients, and the other line of business would be for those fully capitated health plans that wanted to use the PBM, a mechanism for them to pool their purchasing power and hopefully get better discounts from manufacturers as a result of doing that, which is a good thing. We're definitely supportive of that. There are a couple of issues that I just wanted to point out. On the fee-for-service line of business, the bill indicates that it would the PBM would either purchase drugs or in bulk or reimburse pharmacies. The way we do business today with First Health, which is a pharmacy benefits manager for us, is they don't actually reimburse the pharmacies. They do all of the point-of-sale information, the pharmacy interacts, split-second timing with First Health, First Health has edits related to drug utilization review, making sure there aren't any drug-drug interactions, that sort of information, and goes ahead and provides the information to the pharmacy that, you know, their claim is going to move through the system, the client is eligible. But then that information transfers over to our MMIS at night, and actually the check is cut by the MMIS system. And I don't know that there's an intent to necessarily restrict us to a different way of doing that business. And then there may be some issues for the PBM, us contracting with the PBM for the fully capitated health plans. And there'll be some complexities there. We'll have to figure out how the systems work and what is the appropriate pricing mechanism for that. Section 13, I'll jump down to, just deals with a direction to us to go out and secure supplemental rebates, which we would like to do, for fee-for-service drug claims. Although as if we move the prescription drugs fee-for-services under the management of the fully capitated health plans, and the fully capitated health plans are using their formularies and other management tools, it's not very likely that we're going to be able to secure supplemental rebates.
We know that. This so, may be become a useless point. Section at that point.
Yeah.
Mr. Berkovian.
Thank you. And just for clarification, that probably is going to change. Section 13, could we, I think, could we legally even do both, seek rebates under a PBM that will be getting rebates plus trying to negotiate supplemental rebates? That's double dipping, isn't it? Technically, if you, it could be construed as attempting to get, we're basically requiring both, but we could probably do both. Okay.
We'll do our best to maximize the rebates with whatever configuration comes out in the bill. Moving on to Section 15, this is the piece that deals with documenting and verifying residency and eligibility or financial eligibility information. And one comment here, wanted to point out that, you know, we do document residency today, and depending upon what might be meant by verifying residence, that could have a cost associated with it if you want a fleet of state cars going out to make sure someone lives someplace in terms of verification. But I know that isn't what you're looking for.
We want to get rid of a lot of state cars, actually.
and also there was some concern by some who read this bill that the language may actually require us to, on an ongoing basis, document and verify, for example, financial eligibility for someone who's already a client, as opposed to being focused on applicants for the program. And that if that were the case, that that would be costly if we were to do something on a monthly basis. The last comment is Section 17, which is the effective date and the emergency clause, is that concern that we expressed in the beginning that the bill allow for an appropriate operational date that would allow for any approvals that may need to be obtained and for the implementation activities to implement put the changes in effect. And that's it.
Good job. Right on time.
Questions?
I hope I was the last person.
Can I ask one more?
Mr. Berkovian.
Page 5, the buy-in issue. Do we know right now how many clients and to what extent they actually use medical assistance to buy, you know, to spend down their buy-in kind of as a baseline, I guess?
And Tina thought she was going to escape.
And you can correct anything I said that was wrong earlier, please.
No, wait. We don't have another hour and a half.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Tina Kitchen. I'm the medical director for seniors and people with disabilities. I guess the short answer is we can get you that information. As people have been cut from long-term care, some of the people who have been cut are some of the people who are at the lower health need level and are the more likely to have more income still versus people who are more severely impacted. So we're currently rerunning expectations upon how many people in the next biennium. But there was a significant amount, I do believe, around the $165 million, but I'd have to check on that one.
While we got Tina here, we're down to level 11 now, correct?
11.
11. Has there been a significant movement of 12s and 13s down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, by meaning down, you're talking about into the more significantly impacted
right.
levels, survivor priorities, levels 1 through 10. Again, we need to go ahead and get that information for you. We have been looking at those, and we have been going back out to the local communities and making sure that the reassessments have been appropriate and not inappropriate.
I guess one would assume when it was 1 through 17 that as long as you were somewhere in the system, you had access to the same services, basically. And when we start dropping, we'd assume that people would be looking harder at things. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cruz, you're correct. That system was not originally intended to be a mechanism to cut the budget and move people out of service. And so as caseworkers were being faced with people losing services, I think they were much more careful when they did the assessments.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hear your concerns about the timelines between the old and the new. How can the continuum be smooth in terms of dropping the old contracts, getting the new contracts? And when can that best be done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, probably that will mostly depend upon the broader reconfiguration of the Oregon Health Plan. And if you just focused on this bill, which is focused primarily on the managed care delivery system, that would be one piece that could probably happen. Well, it depends upon the amount of CMS approval that may be required. I would say I'd say more likely will be January of 2004. But I would also put that same date out there for more significant changes in the program in terms of who is covered and what they're covered for. So the question, part of the question the state will need to address, I think, in terms of any changes that have to get CMS approval, is how we want to package those changes. Do we want a comprehensive request to go to CMS, or are there some pieces that we want to move more quickly? And will that in any way undermine the broader goals here? And that's the piece yet to be worked out.
Any further questions? Well, seeing none, I guess we're going to let you off the hook now. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll, as soon as we've gone way past our normal closing time, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3624. And if there's no other business before the committee, we'll adjourn.